Dr. Rebecca Daniel Burke, your host for the American Counseling Association's 2010 podcast series. Today we are speaking with Dr. John Summers Flanagan about the book he co-wrote with Rita Summers Flanagan, the second edition to Tough Kids, Cool Counseling. John Summers Flanagan is a faculty member in counselor education at the University of Montana. He's also a mental health consultant for Trapper Creek Job Corps. In the second edition of Tough Kids, Cool Counseling, the authors include a new chapter on resistance busters and establishing rapport. Suicide assessment, medication referrals, and therapy termination are also discussed in this extremely helpful book. Welcome, John.
Hi, Rebecca.
Okay.
Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. The first question I have for you is in Chapter 1, you and Rita talk about how counseling with children and adolescents is like multicultural counseling. I found that fascinating. Now, how does this line of thinking affect the way you work with young people in counseling? And if you can explain a little about what you mean by multicultural counseling with adolescents.
You bet. Now, I don't mean to diminish the real multicultural counseling mm-hmm. that happens when we try to work with people from different ethnic backgrounds.
Right.
But it does seem to me, and it seems to Rita, that there are some similarities or parallels.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I would go back to some of what Darrell Wing Su mm-hmm. said when he talked about how important it is for white counselors when they're working with people of color to be open, because there's the chance that the client may wonder, is this person going to oppress me in the way that other white people have oppressed me in the past? And I guess I think the same kind of thing might be considered by young clients. Is this adult going to boss me around in some of the same ways that other adults have bossed me around? Is this adult going to try to control me? Can I trust this person? Will this adult be able to have empathic understanding? I know that's not the way kids think, but
right.
you know, that's part of what helps develop trust. Can mm-hmm. they actually see things from the youth perspective?
Mm-hmm.
And so those are some of the reasons why we think about it as very similar to multicultural counseling.
Mm-hmm. There is almost a competency one needs. And in some cases, it's really about a developmental competency, isn't it?
I think so. And I mm-hmm. think one of the ways it really feeds into that is that we really need to work on honoring the young client's right of self-determination.
Mm.
Because, you know, developmentally, if we think about the 12 to 18-year-old and Eric Erickson's work on developmental stages, that's a time when there's a little bit of a conflict between identity and role confusion.
Mm-hmm.
And if the person doesn't figure out his or her identity and in a way that respects autonomy, then they become confused and then latch on to things that may be less healthy as a way to define who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And that can set them back, I think, in terms of their developmental progress or trajectory. I also think another important part of this is that young people will sometimes have great ambivalence about adults and about counseling, and that may be with younger clients to some extent, but especially with teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't mind, I have a little story that goes with
this. Yeah, please do. Go ahead.
I was working with a young boy. He was about 10, and sometimes in counseling I'll want to give the young person some freedom and some sense of control. And so I said to this young boy, I said, now for the next 20 minutes, you get to be the boss. You get to be in charge. You get to decide what we do. And he immediately looked at me and said, get out. And I'm thinking, wow, I haven't had this happen to me before.
Mm-hmm.
And so I sometimes when those kinds of things happen, I think I turn a little bit into Carl Rogers, and so I said, so you want me to get out? And he says, get out now.
Mm-hmm.
And so I stand up, and I leave the counseling office, and as soon as the door is shut, I hear him on the inside, and he's yelling out the door, or through the door, get back in here. and again, I'm sort of surprised, and I crack the door, and I peek in. I say, you want me to come back in? And he goes, get in here now. And I get in there, and he goes, sit down. I sit down, and as soon as I sit down, he looks at me again and says, get out. And, you know, I feel like, and then we did that for at least 10 of the 20 minutes, just back and forth, in and out of the room. Mm-hmm. And obviously for this young boy, there may have been some issues that he was acting out, I guess, maybe from his family life. But also, I feel like the story does a nice job of illustrating that sort of ambivalence that young people have, maybe more teenagers than 10-year-olds, but they want the adult figures or their parents in their lives, but they want them out of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to be really sensitive to that developmental, I think, ambivalence.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a wonderful story. I love it. Do you also find yourself, I often found myself when sitting in a consult room with an adolescent, I found myself thinking, is this situation specific? Is it age specific? You know, the particular behavior which had brought them in, you know.
Right,
in
right.
other words, is it just going to go away, you know, when they're no longer teenagers? Or or is there going to be some chronicity with this? Is this going to be a chronic problem? Or is this just, and so many of them are just age specific, situation specific, or developmental specific.
That's a great point, because we don't often know the difference. We don't know if it's going to be a chronic, ongoing problem when they step into the counseling office.
Right.
We just know about the information and the experience that we have with that young person. And it may be something that they'll struggle with for a long time, but like you said, it may just be a very age-specific thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And sometimes our work is really about slowing down some of the behavioral impulses of the young clients we work with. And when you tell that, when you make that point, I think of a story of a young boy who I worked with who was 15, and he was just going to, I'm going to just use more civil language than he did, but he was going to beat the crap out of another kid. And we, in the session, we just kind of went back and forth, and I generated a list with him of all the things he might do, and they all were almost all of them were quite aggressive and vulgar and just terrible things. And at the end of the meeting, he was much calmer, and I said, well, could you just do this with your girlfriend, because it had to do with his girlfriend. Could you just do the same thing with her to see what she thinks? And he goes, sure, and just promise me you won't do anything until we meet again. He goes, yeah. He comes back in about a week later, and I ask him, well, what happened, you know, and he says, about what? and I explain, well, remember the guy you were going to beat the crap out of him? And he says, well, and then he again swore like he tended to do, and referred to his girlfriend in a maybe an unrepeatable way. And then he said, oh, she broke up with me. So the whole thing passed. He never got in a fight. He actually, a week later, was not at all in the middle of that emotional storm. And so sometimes I think our job is to help our young clients, especially teenagers, adolescents, to sort of weather the emotional storms that they're experiencing over and over. And it's very natural, because they're sort of calibrating their emotional life, their emotional identity. And as we can listen to them and help them just delay things a little bit, think about things a little bit more, it can be really helpful.
Yes, it's interesting how we at our age we know that things will pass. At that age, I don't think they know yet that things
will
pass.
Some days I'm not sure things will pass either.
So yeah, that's true.
Maybe that's my immaturity, but you're right. At that time in our lives, I think you feel the pressure of the moment maybe more than when we're older.
Yeah. Also in Chapter 1, I want to bring up something that probably some of our listeners will reel when they hear what I'm going to read. And so in Chapter 1, you and Rita note that this book, quote-unquote, does not advocate empirically supported treatments. given the current emphasis on empirically supported and evidence-based approaches, how can you make this statement?
Well, that might be a little extreme. and maybe being in the mood of, writing about working with teenagers maybe made it so we stated it more extremely than we mm-hmm. should have. But but I also think we don't advocate narrowly defined empirically supported techniques or treatments. Mm-hmm. We do advocate empirically supported or evidence-based principles. And I think maybe we could have discussed that a little bit better in the book. Mm-hmm. In particular, we advocate the therapeutic properties of a positive counseling relationship. There's good mm-hmm. empirical support, evidence base for that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and we advocate using a person-centered kind of counseling skills for highlighting and activating the client's strengths and positive qualities. Mm-hmm. Again, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that what the young person brings into the office mm-hmm. is important to acknowledge and bring out, and help activate their strengths. Mm-hmm. And we also advocate using specific techniques and even empirically supported techniques with youth. Mm-hmm. But our sense in terms of the techniques themselves is that really they're better designed to stimulate a positive relationship, to stimulate positive affect or emotion in the session, mm-hmm. to sort of intrigue the young person and engage the young person, and that the techniques are better for doing that than they are for producing a positive outcome. Mm-hmm. And so in some ways we think of them more as process variables, as we interact using a particular technique with a young person, not so much to produce outcome A, although that may happen, but really to produce a stronger, a more pleasant interaction or relationship between counselor and client.
It reminds me of an experience I had, and I've said this on another podcast, but I'll just say it again, is that an experience I had with a young woman from an inner city neighborhood, and she was, I think she was about 13, and I was using Rogerian technique with her. I was reflecting back, and I remember her suddenly looking at me and saying, "Why are you saying everything I'm saying? I really don't like that." And I thought, wait a minute, they didn't cover this in graduate school.
Okay, what's plan B?
Yeah, what's plan B? So what is your thought about her?
Oh, I think that's a wonderful opportunity. And my graduate students sometimes just roll their eyes back and laugh because mm-hmm. When I'm teaching how to work with young people and when I'm teaching how to do group counseling, mm-hmm. I will tell them that whenever the client speaks up and says that they don't like something you're doing, mm-hmm. your best response is, "I'm so glad you brought that up." because we need to welcome the client's voice, and it's really honoring that perspective. Well, she didn't like that.
Right.
And so you can say, "Wow, I'm so glad you told me mm-hmm. that you don't like that." Now, I've been trained to do that. Mm-hmm. And so I may still do that somewhat, and mm-hmm. I want to apologize in advance if I repeat back to you some of what you're saying. Mm-hmm. But now that you've told me you don't like that, I'm going to try to do some different things, mm-hmm. and we'll see how that goes. Mm-hmm. It's just really, and I think that when your 13-year-old has the guts to speak up and say what she thinks, mm-hmm. That's a really great therapeutic opportunity.
It really was, and I remember, even though I was, I didn't have experience then that I have now, I remember saying something like, "I just want to make sure that I understand what you're saying and that I get it. So if I say it back to you, I'm just trying to make sure I get it." And she was, she kind of looked at me like, "You're stupid." But anyway.
Well, but then you gave her a rationale. You helped her to understand why you were acting the way you were acting, and that teenagers need that. If you think about it, what kind of it's really abnormal for a teenager to mm-hmm. think about, "Let's see, I have a problem. Let me think. I'm 13, inner city. I guess I'll go talk to Rebecca mm-hmm. And you know, and go talk to this professional counselor, and then somehow that situation is going to make me get better or deal with a problem that she may or may not even think she has. And so the whole that whole process is, I think, very unnatural, foreign. It's just not the way a 13-year-old is going to think. Oh, this is the way. This is the way counseling should work.
Yes. Yes.
And so it's a very unusual situation, and I think we need to understand that too.
You know, in the book you describe a number of specific techniques, but you say the purpose of using techniques is to develop a more positive working relationship with the client.
Right.
Can you explain a little more about that and maybe give us an example of a specific technique?
You bet. You know, this really comes from what we've just been talking about, and that is that we really want to try to have positive interactions with young people. Sometimes they come in, teenagers in particular, with a great expectation that this will just be another authority figure who tries to tell me how to live my life.
Right.
And so we need to try to be different. And one thing we can do is we can use particular techniques, and there are a lot of them spelled out in the book, from the hand-pushing technique, which you've got to be really careful with because it involves touch, to this little kind of riddle approach that I use once in a while. I don't use it a lot, and Rita always tells me that it's a really dumb thing to do. and I think rightly so. She says in workshops, she'll say to participants, don't just do these things that John does, because it's not you, and you have to find your own spin or your own way to use some techniques. And for some people, it might be just drawing things, just drawing a picture, and we have that in the book, using a draw a person technique, an old-fashioned assessment procedure, to just do more interactive things with the young person as opposed to do a formal assessment. Although it provides you with some interesting assessment information, too. But the silly riddle thing, I'll just do it with you right now.
Okay.
If you're ready.
Sure.
So, and just respond with whatever comes to mind.
Okay.
Pretend you're a 13-year-old inner-city person.
Okay.
So spell the word silk.
S-I-L-K.
Excellent. And what do cows drink?
Milk.
Well, what do cows drink? Actually, they drink water.
Oh, what do cows drink? They drink water. Oh, yeah, good point.
So I tricked you.
You did trick me.
And sometimes if I'm working with a teenager, I might say, now, sometimes your brain will fool you. And sometimes we'll think things that just aren't quite right. You know, we might think about a situation, and we might be wrong. And, you know, oftentimes the teenager will roll his or her eyes and say, oh, yeah, right, you know. And I'll say, well, if I can show you, can I just demonstrate something with you? And then I might ask them, you know, how do you spell silk? And or do some other little games like that. And it's really a little mental set procedure where you're thinking silk and you think, what do cows drink? And, of course, the first thing that comes into your mind is milk.
Right.
And a lot of the teenagers will then fight with me and they'll say, well, calves drink milk. You know, baby cows drink milk.
Yeah.
I say, what? But all that does is it draws them in and engages them. And then sometimes they will want to do a little riddle or a joke with me. And that's part of, I think, using a technique, a specific little kind of formulaic technique with a young person, and with the purpose of proving a point to some extent, but also just deepening the engagement so that you provide that really sort of an interesting experience.
Yes, absolutely.
And one thing I might do after that is, you know, I'll say, well, you know, it's, you know, you got that one wrong. I've got another one for you. Let's try that. And we might do two or three or four, as many as really it takes for them to get it right.
Right.
And for them to get it right, it requires thinking twice and delaying an initial impulse, and for them to be thinking, oh, I'm, you know, maybe he's trying to trick me. Maybe my brain's trying to trick me. And so what I'm trying to do is to help them see, let's say you're walking down the hall at school, and you say, hi, Cindy. And Cindy doesn't say hi back.
Mm-hmm.
What's the first thought that comes into your mind?
She's mad at me.
She's mad at me.
Yeah.
In other words, so she's mad at you.
Uh-huh.
Maybe you've done something wrong.
Uh-huh.
And if you think about that as an assessment device, that would suggest you have a little bit of an internalizing style, right?
Mm-hmm.
That you've done something and she's mad at you.
Right.
An alternative you might think would, she's just a jerk.
Mm-hmm.
She's just stupid.
Mm-hmm.
And that may or may not be right, and it may or may not be right that she's mad at you.
Mm-hmm.
But then I might ask the student or the client, well, what else might be true in that situation? And so what do you think, Rebecca? What else might be true?
Okay, she was preoccupied.
She was thinking really hard about something.
Right.
Okay.
She didn't notice me.
She didn't notice you.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't have to do with being mad at you.
Right.
And it didn't have to do with her being a jerk.
Right.
She just sort of missed it.
Right.
What else might have happened for her to not respond?
She was thinking about something else. She was on her way to take care of something. Yeah.
Sure, maybe she was on her way. Maybe she was upset about something.
Uh-huh.
And she was really thinking about that and on her way to take care of it. And
mm-hmm.
so, again, it didn't really have to do with you.
Right.
It had to do with something going on inside of her.
Yes.
Yeah. And then, of course, people sometimes say, well, maybe she just didn't hear me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a possibility, too.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are a whole bunch of sort of more innocuous
yes.
explanations or cognitions that the student or the client might be able to generate.
Uh-huh.
And my whole point in that is to bring them into the domain of some cognitive therapy and cognitive behavioral therapy in a way that I think is, well, the title of the book is user-friendly. It includes the phrase user-friendly. And so in a more user-friendly way, try to engage the person and teach a little bit about some cognitive principles.
Yes. That's excellent. That's excellent. Because a lot, even adults think Cindy might not like them. And the truth is, Cindy couldn't have heard. There's so many explanations, so that's
yeah.
a good point.
And they might rush to the conclusion, well, and so since she doesn't like me, I'm never speaking to her again.
Oh,
next
exactly.
Time,
yeah,
next time she says hi to me, I'm not saying hi back.
Right.
Which gives then, and, you know, I know we said we don't advocate narrowly defined evidence-based techniques,
mm-hmm.
but here's one that we do advocate, and that is once you get to that point to do what's called consequential thinking or means-end thinking,
mm-hmm.
where then you work with the young person to say, well, what if you didn't say hi next time? How
mm-hmm.
would she act? What if maybe she didn't hear you, and then she says hi next time, and then you decide not to say hi back? How will that work? What do you think she'll think?
Mm-hmm.
And so you try to analyze the consequences of behavioral alternatives and help the person. So, again, take a step back and evaluate their options.
I love that. That's great.
Thanks.
You also talk about acknowledging reality with young clients. Can you comment on that?
Well, you know, the situation that
mm-hmm.
The counseling is for young people is just a little bit weird.
Yes.
And so sometimes I think, and I don't always say it this way, but I think we need to admit that we're strangers. To admit that this is sort of a weird thing. Now we're going to meet together for 50 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
But also, along with that level of acknowledging reality, to tell them what you know about them. Because usually there's some referral information. It may be a
mm-hmm.
probation officer. It may be a teacher. It may be a parent that has
right.
given you some information. And those people are not the holders of the confidentiality.
Mm-hmm.
And so
mm-hmm.
I think it's important, obviously, to tell them, to tell those outside referral sources, hey, I need some information that I can share
mm-hmm.
with this young person when she or he comes into my office, because it's really important for her or him
mm-hmm.
to know what I know. And so don't just tell me about the problem. Tell me some things that are good about this young person so that I can share that right at the beginning of counseling. You know, usually we, I think, traditionally have focused on and shared the problem. Oh, yeah, you know,
exactly.
Your teacher says,
sure.
Yeah, your teacher says you're just totally difficult in class. What's going on there?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that immediately puts the young person on the defensive. And I think part of the reality is the young person does have a problem, but the young person has some positive qualities too. Maybe a
right.
sparkling personality. You know, maybe they're really a good drawer. Maybe
mm-hmm.
they're good at sports or music, or maybe they just really love their family a lot.
Mm-hmm.
All those things could be part of the description or the reality that we share about mm-hmm. what we know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's also
yeah.
part of kind of Carl Rogers' congruence or authenticity, and that is don't act like we're holding some kind of secret back.
Well, there's also something with adolescents. If somebody comes in and say, you know, and I say, I hear you're having problems with truancy, then I'm the same as everyone else in that I'm not
yep.
treating them like a whole person.
Yep, absolutely.
I'm treating one piece and what might be even one minor symptom that has to do with a lot of other things. But again, I'm one more person, not acknowledging that they're a whole person.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, whether it's a label or whether it's a problem, whatever it is, the more we narrow the way we see the young clients, the more likely they are to resist us. Or if they go along with it, they might just say, yeah, I guess I'm the kind of guy who just has a lot of trouble. I guess I'm just, you know, I have a lot of truancy problems. That's just who I am. And we don't want to conclude that either. So.
In Chapter 4,
mm-hmm.
you and Rita focus on what you call rapid emotional change techniques. Why would rapid emotional change techniques be needed in counseling with youth? And can you describe how you might use one in a session?
You bet.
Okay.
You know, I think from working with young people and also from the research literature, one of the things that brings them to counseling most often is some problem with mood or irritability.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly there are some behavioral problems, but oftentimes the behavioral problems are linked to irritability or bad moods.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of our jobs, I think, is to help young people have a more positive emotional experience in counseling. And that's because I think positive emotions make us more pleasant. Again, the research supports that. They make us more cooperative. They make us better problem solvers. And there's some research to suggest that if you're in a good mood, you're better at solving problems. And that makes perfect sense because, you know, our minds are more open and we're not engaging in or experiencing a mental constriction where we're feeling bad and just think of bad, unhopeful futures. And so just doing things to produce positive affect or rapid emotional change techniques is something that I think is quite important with young people. And I remember one young boy coming in just really in a bad mood, and he came in with his dad, and they got in a little, you know, conflict at the very beginning of the session because I was seeing dad a little bit with him at the beginning, and then I was seeing the young man, 12-year-old, by himself. And once dad left, you know, instead of saying, oh, wow, you guys were having a terrible conflict, we should talk about that, I just said, I used a distraction technique. And as we know with toddlers, redirection or distraction is a really important thing to do.
Right.
And the same thing, I think, is a little bit true with pre-adolescence and adolescence. And
mm-hmm.
so I just said to him, hey, you know, I remember you really like, I mean, he really liked the Utah Jazz basketball team. I remember you really like them. How are they doing this year?
Mm-hmm.
Are you still following them on that? And
mm-hmm.
and he was sort of taken aback, but he answered the questions. I said, you know, one thing that seems like is true with them every year is they start off really well, and then they just sort of fade, and they end up not doing so well. And he just got into talking and telling me about that. And then, you know, 5 minutes later, we can come back to, yeah, you and your dad were kind of having a little conflict, I noticed, and he was in such a better mood by that point that
mm-hmm.
we were able to talk about it as opposed to him being in that irritable, nasty mood state, which would have made
you,
him go
you almost
further.
Forced it to pass.
Yeah.
We were talking earlier about how we know things will pass. Just wait a little bit, they'll pass. And adolescents don't necessarily know that. You force that to pass, and yeah, rapid.
Yeah. It's really, I was just sort of ignoring it. I thought, well, things are not going to go well if I dive into trying to analyze this conflict immediately.
Right.
So let's just talk about something else.
Yes.
Which really is, it fits with that sort of developmental style that young people have, and that is they don't always want to jump right into having a serious talk.
Right, exactly. I mean, I have found with children and even with some adolescents to, I don't know, have something in front of them, some toy type thing, a piece of clay, you know, just something. You know, they start playing with it, they start using it, and before you know it, they're starting to tell me some things. Yeah.
Right. And that helps them just feel more comfortable, and that's part of a rapid emotional change technique. You give them something comforting, which helps them to feel better, and then they're more able to talk openly.
Mm-hmm.
I have this other thing I do sometimes. I started doing recently. I'm working with older teenagers a lot more now. And I had a young woman come in, and she was just in a terrible mood. And then the same day, I had a young man come in and said that he had been taking some psychostimulant because he was having some attention problems. And he said, oh, you know, I just don't even feel like myself. And in both these situations, what I did was I just started doing a very brief body scan technique with them where I just said, well, let me just do this thing. It'll just take us about 3 or 4 minutes. Just one of the amazing things about our bodies, and I got in a seating position where we could kind of both look at the wall together, is that if you want, you can just think of your toes right now. And you might not have thought of your toes all day. So just think about your toes and that they're in your shoes and just think how they feel, and we'll just curl them up and let them go, and so I just kind of worked my way up, and you know, think about your knees, and just sort of flex your legs a little bit, and then you know, I had them make little muscle things, and then I work all the way up to their face, and I say, now just pay attention to your face, and now scrunch it up in a really funny looking position, and almost always by the time you get there. Again, this is just 3 or 4 minutes. By the time you get to the face and they're scrunching their face up, they can't do it without giggling. They just, it's like,
yeah.
And we're in a position where you can kind of see each other too, and so they can see me doing it, and they look over, and I'll say, well, you don't have to pay any attention to me. Just try to, you know, and they'll be laughing because I'm making a horrible face. But we're just doing this together, and we're just sort of getting in touch with our bodies, and we're just sort of not focusing on whatever the distressing thing is that the person was feeling when they walked in.
Sure.
And this young man, you know, it was funny. He'd been on a higher dose of the psychostimulant, and then he said, I just didn't feel like myself. And after we got done with this, he said, ooh, I feel so much better. And he says, can we do some of that mental imagery stuff that you do sometimes?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, sure, we can do that. And so then we did a little visualization.
Yeah.
And he felt so much better at the end of our time that I'm just sometimes surprised at how quickly things will pass if we can help the young person move past the negative emotions and into a little bit more pleasant emotional state.
Right, exactly.
Doesn't mean that I don't think we should ever talk about hard things.
Right.
But just that to try to confront or deal with a bad mood directly with young people is often just not productive.
Right. And in the beginning, relationship building is so important. It's important all the way through, but it's certainly important in the beginning with adolescents.
Yes.
And so, you know, to do some of these things, you know, they sound very good because, for one, they could teach the young person to do it themselves, to calm themselves, which I love that idea. But the other part is you're still looking at the whole person as opposed to just the boy who's truant.
Yes.
Yeah,
exactly.
I like that.
Exactly.
One of the things we haven't talked about yet, which every time I've worked with adolescents, this is a tricky subject, and that is the parents. So how do you recommend that our counselors work with parents when you're counseling the young people?
I guess if the question is, how should we work with parents, I would say the answer is very carefully.
Yes, yes.
And, but I would add to that very respectfully.
The
parents, it's so easy for us as counselors to malign parents.
It is, yes.
To judge them, and sometimes for good reason.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also very true that parents feel vulnerable and often judged and criticized by our society or by our culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so they will enter into a counseling situation on high alert, very defensive.
Sure. And coming from a place of, I'm a terrible parent.
I feel terrible about, you know, my parenting. What can I do? And so to jump into giving advice or acting like I know more than you do or whatever negative way we might lead is really important to avoid. It's really important to respect parents, to try to do some, and this could be a whole podcast of itself, just working with parents, but to listen to what they have to say, but at the same time limit how much they can focus on negative things. I'm reminded of often when parents will enter the room if they're with their 12-year-old, you know, or their 8-year-old. They will walk in, and that kid will be with them, and they'll say, let me give you a list of things that are wrong with my child that I want you to fix.
Right.
They don't usually use exactly that language, but they say something like that.
It's
and they'll start
like
a laundry list, right?
Yeah.
And I always stop them. I say, hey, here's the deal. We're going to talk about goals, what you guys would like to accomplish with counseling, and I always start with the youngest person first, but we're going to get to you.
That's good.
Then I ask the young person, because if I don't ask them first, they won't be able to answer in a way that's not spoiled by what the parents said.
Exactly, yeah.
So
yeah.
I listen to the, and most of the time the kids will say, I don't know. And that's fine. At least that they've been respected in this process. And I'll say, well, you can think of something later. That's fine.
Okay, yeah.
Or I might say, well, you know, let me just give you three wishes. If you had three wishes, one wish, you know, how would you like your school to change? And second wish, how would you like your parents to change? And third one, how would you like yourself to change? And sometimes they can answer that. Sometimes they can't. But then I move to the parents and I say, well, we have a limit of three. You can only mention three things that you'd like for your goals. And so I'm trying to emphasize positive. What would you like to be better? And most parents will get that really quickly and they'll say, oh, okay, yeah, I get it. Now I understand what's expected of me. What would I like to be better? And they can limit themselves to three. And if they can't, I'll sort of stop them. But when they're talking, I'm writing down their goals in a very respectful way, and I'm repeating it back to them using those nice Carl Rogers listening skills so that they know that, this guy or this counselor is listening to me and respecting my perspective and wants to know what I want. And then with younger kids, I would say one way to work with parents would be completely separately, to just do parenting consultations with the parents to help coach them in a positive way about how to be a more encouraging parent who can break some of the negative patterns, because that's really what you're focusing on. It's not so much I try to avoid problem language. It's like a pattern. It's an interaction. Everybody would like that interaction, that pattern, to be different.
Yes.
How do we change it?
Yes. And some, you know, I'm reminded of when I had a private practice years ago. I saw this little girl and her father, and they had a problem of the little girl would be with him in a store, and she'd suddenly start screaming, and it just freaked him out. He'd never had a child, and what is she doing? And I'm embarrassed, and I'm scared, and I think people might think I abused her or something. You know, he just had this whole thing. And we worked on it, and we really, extinguish that behavior. It was really gone. We worked on it, and there was just a bunch of things happening. And when it was over with, I remember him coming in and saying that he wanted a session with me, and I said, fine, and he came in, and he cried through the whole session, and he said he couldn't even remember when he'd cried in his life, that maybe it was when he was a little boy that he never cried, but just, I guess, the stress and the buildup of my little girl doesn't, hates me for some reason, and she didn't. It was just a, you know, it's just one of those things you had to, their cues were wrong with each other, and we had to get them in line. And
yeah.
And I thought, boy, you know, if he hadn't have asked, I wouldn't have said, why don't you come in for a session? And boy, did he need that session, you know?
Yeah.
I'm wondering, you know.
What a great story about how you worked with him in such a way that he had then great trust for you, that he would be able to come in and cry when he hadn't
like
cried
that.
For years.
Yeah. It was, you know, it wasn't anything I'd expected. I thought he was going to come in and say, you know, moving forward, how do we prevent this? You know, something very, because he was very in his head, you know, so something very strategic. And it was just crying about how it's very painful for parents to think they may have failed when they're trying so hard, most of them.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
I have a manuscript I'm working on right now on parenting consultations. And
oh.
One of the topics or one of the interventions mm-hmm. is to give compliments,
yeah.
to find specific things to compliment the parent on.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes, and the compliment can be, and when I use this one, and I only use it when I believe it,
uh-huh.
When I've heard the parent say something that makes me think this thought,
uh-huh.
I'll say to the parent, you know, your daughter is lucky to have you as a parent.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
and I'll say that, and their eyes will just tear up.
Yes.
And,
yes.
you know, it, especially if I mean it, right? And
mm-hmm.
if they're feeling like, oh, we're trying everything. And so they have one of two kind of responses. One is that they tear up a little bit, and the other one is, yes, but what can I do?
Mm-hmm.
I need some more skills.
Right.
Okay, that's,
right.
That's fine. We can work on all kinds of tools you can use. And,
right.
And I got to tell you, sometimes we have a toolbox full of tools, and you try them all, and sometimes it's just the way kids are.
Mm-hmm.
None of them work very well.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean we should stop trying, because
that's right.
as long as we keep trying, there's sort of a meta message that mm-hmm. we're giving to our kids, that we're still in this game. We're still invested in this going
yeah.
well. And still want our child to turn out okay.
And sometimes, and this is what they don't know, which is so scary, it just passes. Whatever the
yeah.
thing was,
yeah.
you've tried all your tools in your toolbox, and you're like, oh, my gosh. And it just passes. The,
yeah.
the behavior passes.
And it may have nothing to do with the tools you tried.
Right.
And then again, it may have to do with something.
Right.
And the thing that surprises me is sometimes when I ask teenagers afterwards, I sometimes interview them afterwards about what worked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I got in my head, I know I did this.
Mm-hmm.
I have this one story I tell. I used neo-dissociation. It's this technique that I know that's what worked.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm interviewing this young woman, this girl, mm-hmm. and she says, oh, no, that was stupid. It wasn't that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Now I want to move to a subject that really worries me about teens. I know last year I can think of two incidences where I got calls here at the American Counseling Association from a counselor who had experienced their first teenage client suicide. And talk about devastation of a counselor. You know, I mean, this person feels that they were responsible in some way for the young person's mental health since they were their counselor. And the student commits suicide. It's just devastating. Now you describe what is really your constructive critique of traditional suicide assessment strategies. Can you talk a little about that? We all need to know how to do a better job with that, because boy, is it important.
You bet. And mm-hmm. I can relate to the devastation. I remember a 15-year-old boy I worked with who
mm-hmm.
killed himself. And
mm-hmm.
I can still vividly remember the boy's brother calling me, older brother calling me and telling me that he'd killed himself, and just feeling like I'd completely screwed up and that
yeah.
it was all my fault. And what, you know, and feeling also the anxiety about legal issues.
Well, yes, and these two counselors who called me, they also were saying, I can't stop second-guessing myself. I keep saying, if I would have said blah, blah during that one session instead of saying blah, blah, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, and suicide is one of those things where we shouldn't deal with it alone. So I'm glad those professionals called you.
Mm-hmm.
I also would recommend supervision groups for those of us who work with suicidal teenagers.
Yeah.
It's really good to have other perspectives and support and reassurance.
Mm-hmm.
The constructive critique mm-hmm. is really, again, I don't want to be too extreme. I know sometimes I feel like I'm being extreme, but
mm-hmm.
the traditional approach is that the counselor is an expert
mm-hmm.
who needs to ask all the right questions to discover if the client is suicidal and then intervene appropriately.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that that's not true, but also it's a little bit paradoxical because we also need to balance our questions because the traditional approach would be, you know, have you thought about suicide? Do you have a plan?
Mm-hmm.
What is the method? How lethal is it? You know, have you made
right.
previous attempts? And I know you've done a podcast with an expert in
right.
suicide assessment, and I know I listened
mm-hmm.
to that, and I thought to myself, that's a great approach,
mm-hmm.
but we have to balance it.
Mm-hmm.
We have to balance it with positive questions. Positive questions.
Give us an example.
About hope. What gives you hope? What helps you feel better?
Mm-hmm.
Positive questions about mood. What brings your mood up? Tell me a time when your mood was higher and what was happening. Positive questions about calmness and relaxation. What calms you down? How do you feel better? When do you feel best? Positive questions about interpersonal connection, you know. Who do you like being with? Who helps you feel a little bit better? Who helps you feel a little worse? But then who helps you, you know, how do you get back up after that? So to be focusing on the positive, even with sleep, you know,
mm-hmm.
when do you sleep best? When do you sleep worst? How do you get yourself in a place where you can sleep better?
Mm-hmm.
So I think the problem I see is that if we just focus on ideation, plan, risk factors, previous
right.
attempt, you know, alcohol use.
Mm-hmm.
Even one of the weird things in the field is oftentimes we talk about focusing on hopelessness.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's just a negative version of hope. And so we could focus on hope.
Mm-hmm.
We could focus on the method they use to feel better instead
mm-hmm.
of the method they use to think about suicide. And so,
mm-hmm.
so that's really what I mean. It's not that we should not be have expertise,
right.
but that we need to balance our positive and negative questions, and we need to look empathically and collaboratively at the client's experience of distress
mm-hmm.
and not just be an outside authority that's trying to figure out how to intervene.
Mm-hmm.
David Jobes, I think he's at Catholic University of America,
mm-hmm.
and he has written a lot of really good stuff on a collaborative approach to suicide assessment with adolescents, and I really recommend that highly.
Is there a book title you can tell us?
You know, I'm blanking on it right now.
It's okay. You know, we'll put it on the link when we set up the announcement for this podcast. We'll put
Thank
a link
you.
In it.
Thank you
yeah.
for not...
No problem.
Me about my lack of ability to remember the reference. I do know it's
no
David
problem.
Jobes.
Okay, good. Good. That's where I had there. I love that idea, and I have to tell you, I rarely think of asking them about the upside of all of those things that are on the suicide assessment. That's an extremely good point.
Well, you know, I discovered this a little bit inadvertently in that I was teaching a course on clinical interviewing.
Mm-hmm.
And I had all of my students role-play suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And after they get done role-playing suicide with each other, suicide assessment, so one was the assessor
mm-hmm.
and the other one was the client. And,
right.
And after they got done, they said they just felt terribly depressed, you know?
Yeah.
We're using a traditional
sure.
model. And, you know, the kinds of questions that we ask diagnostically are, do you feel down more often than you feel up?
Yes.
Do you having trouble sleeping?
Uh-huh.
Do you have diminished sexual desire? I mean, all these things
uh-huh.
are phrased in the negative.
Right, right.
And at the end, everybody's like, oh, man, I feel terrible. And I thought, well, we need to not be out of balance. Again, not that we should ignore the traditional approach, but that we should balance it with the positive.
Yeah. I know once when I worked in a psychiatric hospital, I was doing an intake with a young person, and I remember saying, have you ever been in a funk like this before? And if so, what did you do to get out of it? You know, even that's very positive. I didn't think of it that way until just now, but that's a positive.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's a great,
do?
I think that the solution-focused people would say you were using a solution-focused technique.
Yes, solution-focused.
And helping the person, and Glasser would say you're helping the person focus on a past success experience, which is the only kind of success, or only kind of past experiences that Glasser would like people to focus on.
Right, exactly.
And so you're doing both those things. It's very positive.
Okay, well, that's great. I think you helped a lot of people with that. Now, the last question I have for you, it's a big question, and that is, what do you think about the effectiveness of medication versus counseling when working with youth, and is there an advantage to combining medications with counseling?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm a counselor educator, and I'm not a psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm.
And so I should apologize in advance to all the physicians out there listening.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, I think that, and maybe I should apologize to the pharmacologists, but I actually think the evidence is pretty clear that counseling is a better option.
Mm-hmm.
I have a recent publication in the Journal of Contemporary Psychotherapy in June of 2009. The title is Psychotherapy and or Medications for Depression in Youth.
Oh, great. Maybe we can put a link on about that,
yeah,
too.
Yeah,
great.
And
okay.
It's an evidence-based review.
Okay.
And the data would suggest, and in the biggest study of its kind, which was the TADS study, the Treatment of Adolescent Depression study, what they found was at 12 weeks, now this is going to sound bad for counseling at first, but at 12 weeks, the combination of Prozac plus cognitive behavioral therapy produced 71% positive outcome.
Okay.
Prozac by itself was 60%.
Mm-hmm.
Cognitive behavioral therapy by itself was 43%. And placebo by itself was 35%. So that doesn't sound good.
Right.
At 18 weeks, there's no significant difference between cognitive behavior therapy and Prozac. Interesting.
Mm-hmm. At how many weeks?
At 18 weeks.
Okay, go ahead.
At 36 weeks, now there's no difference between cognitive behavior therapy, Prozac, and the combination. They're all now the same at 36 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And now you might say, well, so they're all about equal. Well, in that particular study, they also looked at adverse events and side effects.
Mm-hmm.
And the young people, this was 12 to 18-year-olds, who took Prozac had about a 12% chance of showing harm-related adverse events, cutting themselves or banging their head or something like that.
Okay.
That happened at a 4.5% rate in the cognitive behavioral group, so more than twice as often. And that's interesting, but then to me, the huge reason to go with counseling is that 21% of the patients in that study had psychiatric adverse events, and if they were in the Prozac group, and only 1% in the cognitive behavioral group.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're seeing is that there are adverse events and side effects at a very high rate when young people take antidepressant medications.
Wow.
In addition, the only other study that I found that directly compared cognitive behavioral therapy versus an SSRI or an antidepressant medication was a study in 2006 on cognitive behavior therapy versus Zoloft versus the combination of both. And in that study, 71% of the youth had a positive outcome with cognitive behavior therapy, 33% with Zoloft, mm-hmm. and 47% with the combination, and it was significant.
I
just don't think there's any evidence. And if you look closely at the previously published medication studies, mm-hmm. antidepressant studies, and I just think mm-hmm. we're better off trying to provide counseling, although sometimes, on occasion, mm-hmm. the medication might produce quicker effects. Mm-hmm. If we're looking at the long term, I like to quote my behaviorist friends who would say, a pill is not a skill, mm-hmm. and that we need to teach people skills for living, skills for having better relationships, instead of pills to help them kind of numb or be distracted from or not have the bad feelings.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Every now and then, I want to say in support of people who use medication for a very short period of time, mm-hmm. I want to say every now and then it seems like an adolescent is so distraught that mm-hmm. a course of medication for a very limited amount of time sometimes seems to be helpful.
Yeah.
I've seen this work again and again. What I don't like is when that counselor or psychiatrist or, you know, whatever the collaboration is to get the child medication, when they see it as a long-term solution. I think that's a mistake.
Yeah. Well, you know, and in some cases, I think with more extreme depression, mm-hmm. I'm totally fine with medication use. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't say totally fine. I mm-hmm. think I have some reluctance about it. I have some concerns about it. I think it's overdone.
Yeah.
I think that we overestimate its effectiveness.
Mm-hmm.
But I also agree with you completely that it can be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And I would not. I would emphasize that we need to talk with young people about medications in ways that help them see what they're doing to make changes
mm-hmm.
instead of attributing all the change to the medication or a chemical imbalance, which is really a phrase that was made up by drug companies.
Yeah, who made up that phrase?
I mean, chemical imbalance, one of the psychiatrists who I worked with said, uh-huh. you know, if you speak Spanish and I don't, we have different chemical balances in our brains. And
uh-huh.
so the whole idea of a chemical imbalance as a generic issue is silly.
That's a good point. And I would say the vast number of young people will do just fine with talk therapy that emphasizes some very creative approaches.
Yeah. I agree.
Yeah. Just that small group, though, that is so distraught, and you do worry that this person might end their lives, you know.
Right. And the interesting thing about the antidepressants, mm-hmm. like Prozac and Zoloft, mm-hmm. Celexa, is that the data suggests that, on average, if you give those medications to someone who's not suicidal, it will increase their suicidality.
Oh, great.
But on average, if you give it mm-hmm. to people who are already suicidal, mm-hmm. it will decrease their suicidality.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, a really important distinction that a lot of people don't talk about when they talk about the, you know, the black box warning and some
mm-hmm.
of the
mm-hmm.
issues associated with antidepressants with young people.
Yeah.
And that it does produce agitation, akathisia, uh-huh. these kind of negative, kind of a little bit crazy and violent thoughts
mm-hmm.
in a small percent of 2 to 5% of the youth. But if the person's already suicidal,
mm-hmm.
you have some chance of the medication reducing the suicidality,
right.
and that might be a very appropriate time.
Right, for just a period of time where you can do some major interventions.
Yeah.
That is, that's a wonderful point. And thank you for bringing up those studies. They sound fascinating. And again, we'll try to get some links on our website to that.
Great.
Is there anything I have not asked you that you want to say to our audience? And our listeners are mostly working counselors who see, you know, all kinds of clients. So is there anything I haven't asked that you want to say to our listeners?
Yeah, I would say maybe this is related to my less positive feelings about medications and my positive feelings about counseling. And that is, I just want to empower counselors to recognize that the techniques, especially developing positive relationships with the young people and helping young people work through their problems, these are really very potent approaches to helping people change for the better. And so I want to just let counselors know how powerful they are, and also to help them know how important they are in the lives of young people, because often the young people will not, after a session, say, thank you. That was so great.
I really learned a lot.
Yeah. You are really a good counselor. You know, once in a while, young people will say that, and it's so rewarding. But I would like to say to the counselors out there who work with challenging young people, thank you. These young people need you so much, and it's so important you're there to help them through difficult emotional and interpersonal situations in their life.
And all of the school counselors out there, thank you. Because
yes, totally.
talk about a tough job these days.
Talk about being in the you know, waist deep or maybe higher in the river of human need.
Yes,
our school counselors are exposed to the gamut of human problems.
Absolutely. They absolutely are. Well, thank you so much, Dr. John Summers Flanagan, for joining us to discuss your book, Tough Kids, Cool Counseling, Second Edition.
And thank you for having me.
Great. To view links to this program or to write to the presenter or the host, go to www.counseling.org and click on the podcast page. This is Rebecca Daniel Burke, your host for the ACA 2010 podcast series, signing off.